out of my skin.
Oh, I don't know what I'm doing. Then. Let's go to... What are we going to do here? Let's see. 3680, public hearing, possible work session. Anybody here care about 3680? 3680.
Somebody's coming for.
3680. Hi.
Good morning.
I don't have my little list, so... I don't have my list, so you'll just have to introduce yourself for the record and then begin there.
Chairman, my name is Gina Skinner. I'm the Deputy District Attorney. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney Association. The Oregon District Attorney Association is strongly in support of House Bill 3680. I have some written testimony here from also that I'm bringing from Katie Yetter.
Okay, Bill, you support it also?
Yep.
All right, if I understand correctly, what this bill does is allow the introduction of certain prior convictions of conduct that is related to domestic violence, and in the sense that I'm just saying this so you'll understand how ignorant I am.
Chair, would you like me to briefly explain?
Oh, I want to sit here and just blather on.
Okay. Chairman, this bill specifically enumerates the crimes that it's referring to. It talks about if you're going to trial on a case, and it lists several of them, A through O, including aggravated murder, manslaughter, assault, rape, sodomies, harassment, menacing, sexual abuse. If you're going to trial on those cases and the defendant is a witness in that case, that currently under law under Oregon Evidence Code 609, there are certain prior criminal convictions that would be used as impeachment evidence only against the defendant as a witness. That would include cases that have to do with the defendant's truth or honesty or convictions that are felonies. But that does not include current under the law misdemeanors that don't fall under either of those categories. This law would say that under if you're going to trial on domestic violence crime that's in that one list, that five other misdemeanor domestic violence crimes, which include assault in the fourth degree, which is an A misdemeanor, menacing, which is an A misdemeanor, harassment, which is a B misdemeanor, attempted assault four, which is a B misdemeanor, and attempted felony assault four, which is an A misdemeanor, those prior convictions, if domestic related, would be used as impeachment evidence.
And Billy, Bill's in favor of this, right?
Compromise, but we agree.
Mr. Chair, work session.
Work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3680 A and Groves, Senate floor, the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3680 A and Groves to the floor of the Senate, the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. Ordered. Let me see who wants to be.
Sure.
Senator Beyer will carry this bill. And.
I feel so too.
You're a morning person, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Are the parties here on 3912? Or not? Or do you want to go to another one?
That's the end. This one's mine, 3461. That's one you want to have on me.
3461, work session. We have an agreement on this thing, hopefully.
3461?
Yeah. This is the one with the.
You set them out in the hall?
Yeah.
So this should be the.
All right.
Let's look at the amendments here.
Which amendments do we have?
Mr. Chairman, you should have the dash one amendments to 3461. It should be at the bottom of your packet, I think.
The bottom?
Yeah, the last part of your packet. Mr. Chairman, members of committee, 3461, the dash one amendments increase the sanction units available for a judge when there's a probation violation that's been found. They can use, they're increasing it by. Not more than 60 days to direct the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to do so. I think this is the product of the hallway.
All right,
work
group people, come on up. Who are you? OCDL is okay with it? Y'all fine? Everybody's fine? What's the dash what?
Dash one.
Work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3461.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 3461. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3461 as amended to the Senate floor do pass.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3461 as amended to the floor of the Senate to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered, and I'll carry.
Okay, buddy.
Good
man.
And
send him out in the hall.
It works. It actually works, for God's sakes.
It does. Courthouse steps. Famous statement in law.
Okay, we're going to go to 3912 here.
Got it.
3912, public hearing, possible work session. Who's the proponent? Are you Richard Vile?
I am.
Okay.
We'll be briefed by Chair Minnis, members of the committee. With me today on the proponent side is Barbara Kahns, who has long worked with the Homeowner Association and condominium legislation for about the past 25 years. David Bennett, a lawyer from Portland, who has worked with it for an equally long period of time. I also have seated with me here Harriet Heise of Bend, who originally was the requester of a companion bill in the House, which now is embodied in this bill, or the compromises are embodied in our bill, and Representative Merkley, with whom I've worked over the last couple of weeks and especially the last couple of days to reach some good compromises that this bill now embodies. What you have in front of you is an A-10. One person I forgot to mention, I apologize, Barbara just gave me a note, Brian DeMarco of the Real Estate Agency is also with us today, and I believe has looked at these provisions.
Where is Brian?
Brian's right back here.
Okay, you support the A-10?
I support the A-10.
You all support the A-10?
We all support the A-10.
Anybody opposed to the A-10? Anybody opposed to this bill?
What are the
Mr. Chair?
I move 6s, 7s, and 8s are they all incorporated?
Disregard those.
Everything's embodied in the A-10s.
It's a signal to me. Go quick on this one. Mr. Chair, I move the dash A-10 amendments to House Bill 3912.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the A-10 amendments to House Bill 3912. Discussion? Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3912 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass.
Fast. Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3912 to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation as amended by this committee. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Courtney will get carried out.
I'll carry that. Thank you. So pleased that we are beyond.
Because the green one is not
green.
What happened? New rate. That's not it. That's my other question.
Is this one by yourself?
Okay.
You bitter?
No.
Sorry, Andrew.
All right.
Nice party.
Let's see. Need reconsideration on House Bill 2429.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for purposes of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2429.
Senator Courtney moves that we suspend the rules for the purposes of reconsideration of House Bill 2429. As far as discussion is concerned, if I understand correctly, we have some conflict amendments in civil forfeiture.
We do?
And criminal forfeiture.
Well, wait a minute. You're saying we can't do this because we don't have 5 votes? And you're not going to do it?
There's only 4 of us here, isn't there?
Well, we've been doing everything with just 4.
But to suspend rules, it takes 5 minutes.
How old are you, Mr. Chairman?
Hang on. Hang on just a
second. You know, let's just wing it.
Thank you.
Okay, right. We just did it.
Senator Courtney moved that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsideration of working on House Bill 2429. Discussion, any objections? Hearing none.
Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2429 with due pass recommendation to the Senate floor.
Senator Courtney moves that we reconsider the vote by which we sent House Bill 2429 to the Senate with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Counsel.
We have the A-10 amendments before us this morning. It includes a conflict amendment and a change to the DUII forfeiture provision, which deletes the language bail forfeiture or security. Their ballot measure 3 requires a conviction.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney.
Are we in work session?
We are, sir.
I move dash A-10 amendments to House Bill 2429.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of A-10 amendments to House Bill 2429. Discussion? Objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2429 as amended to the Senate floor due pass.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2429 as amended to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none. So ordered. That one's gone. Again. Peter, you're the carrier on that.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Whatever.
All right.
Cowboys.
To get around measure 3 bill.
Do we want to talk? Let's talk about House Bill 2007, at least for the purpose of getting before the committee, what agreement might exist. Do we have the parties here? This bill deals with minor decoy operations. There's been some negotiations and some facilitation, such a...
Can we pass it out today, Jim? You don't know.
I want to hold it because there's another issue going on in another committee.
All right. Chip, do you want to talk, or who wants to? Brian, you want to go?
Mr. Chair, good morning. Members of the committee, my name is Chip Lazenby. For the record, we've worked on these, and on the A9s, I'd just like to say kumbaya, I think everybody else is here.
I hate that word. I hate that word.
I wish I knew what it meant.
We are all in agreement on the A9s.
And I'll never use it again.
That's the literal translation from the...
Why don't you tell us what the A9s are intended to do? Or...
We have... the discussions, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, have been around the use of random or targeted decoy operations with licensees for determining whether they're selling to minors. These amendments would essentially direct the OLCC to develop rules and standards by rule for cities larger than 20,000 for random decoy operations, and sets out also the terms under which targeted minor decoy operations could occur. All of this is going to be further defined by administrative rule by the agency, and that's consistent with the parties' negotiations and understanding how this will be implemented after if this piece of legislation goes into law.
Okay, and Brian, you're...
We're in agreement.
Right. Okay, why don't we, if I can, we can adopt the A9 amendment, and we're going to hold on to the bill. We're going to actually recess because there's actually something going on in another committee that may affect what happens to this bill ultimately. So,
Mr. Chair.
Work session.
I move the dash A9 amendments to House Bill 2007.
Okay. Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the A9 amendment to House Bill 2007. Any discussion? Any objections? That's ordered, and we'll close the work session then on that. And let's see, we had a little issue yesterday, 2394. Let's see, who are they? Okay, so this is one we don't have an agreement on. Is that correct? So that, all right. It was Representative Williams going to chat on this issue?
I think so. He was
going to
be here on 3913.
3913.
None of all these bills. All
right.
Margaret Taylor.
Is that an agreement? Okay. So. Margaret Taylor, why don't you come up for a minute, and then we'll bring...
Oh, yeah, this is that bill.
Oh, no. Everybody does a big sigh when I get up here. That's a bad sign.
So we have a choice before us.
Yeah, the difficulty with this bill, it's fairly simple, so there's not a lot of different provisions where you can...
You need to identify yourself for the
record. I'm Margaret Taylor.
All right, now go ahead. The difficulty.
There's not many provisions where there's room for a lot of give and take on this bill. It's a simple bill, and there's basically just the essential elements, and there's not a lot of wiggle room.
All right.
Essentially, it will either work to help the situation or it won't work to help the...
Dale, would you frame the issue for me, Dale, from your perspective?
Mr. Chair, Dale Penn, District Attorney Association. Law enforcement supports the engrossed bill that came out of the House. In my estimation, this basically boils down to arrest information would be available for the pre-commitment investigator and the judge in a civil commitment hearing. And one of the issues is dangerousness. And so past arrest activity would be available. It is not conclusive. It is simply one small piece of information that would be available before a decision would be made. A judge would be able to weigh that. It's very similar in other situations. In criminal sentencing, arrest information is available for the judge. In death penalty litigation, where a jury must make a decision about dangerousness, all prior misconduct is available, whether it was a conviction or not. And the policy issue is I think the opponents of the engrossed bill only want conviction information available to the court and pre-commitment investigator. This bill allows arrest information for whatever it's worth in the entire hearing process to be available. I think that's the policy issue.
All right. Okay. Andrea, you're sitting there with a grimace on your face.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. As I testified, was it day before yesterday?
Well,
I believe yesterday
no,
on this bill. Our concern particularly has to do with access to the records for the 24-hour period where the whole determination is made by the Mental Health Division, and that's both arrest and conviction for the determination.
Tell me what's wrong with having access to the information. What's the...
As I testified the other day, we feel there are a few concerns. This information is possibly given at a very quick turnaround over the phone in the middle of the night where there isn't the opportunity to fully safeguard that all the information is accurate and complete. It is given to an individual who's not certified. I'm sorry, Senator Courtney, you...
No, go ahead. Okay. I have a question.
Okay. Who is not certified for the training and the information to be received, and is then making a determination whether the person is held because they present a danger at that moment to themselves or others. We were neutral on the portion that had to do with the investigation week.
Help me understand. What's the defect that's presented, if any, by having...
The risk that there's no judicial oversight, there's no... that this information can be wrong, inaccurate, incomplete, that you're actually holding someone and taking away their very freedoms based on some past arrest or convictions, not what they're currently showing before the individuals and the medical providers about their clear and their danger at that time.
Senator Courtney.
All right, you mentioned 24 hours. Let's make it a longer period.
Well, Senator Courtney, I'm not. If you're talking about the longer period, then that is where we get into the second part of what was the original part of the bill, and I wish there were some other folks here who've been far more involved in this whole process, but let me try to address. The original bill allowed for the investigation, the seven-day period. And so we're less concerned with the safeguards there, but when you're talking about a quick turnaround to...
You're not opposed to arrest records being made available. But that doesn't bother... You can live with all that. We're not going to get into that.
Because they were neutral and they could live with it, I think.
Senator Courtney, to me there are two discrete issues. Let me try to be clear at the early hour, that so I might not be. One is access to arrest or conviction, access to the lead system entirely, within the first 24-hour period by the mental health providers. Number two issue in the original bill was access to the leads, both arrest or convictions, but I believe there actually was just convictions in the seven in the original bill.
They had access, but you couldn't include arrest.
The other issue is the access over the seven-day period to the leads record.
All right, but again, I want to go back. It seems to me, if Dale is correct, it just kind of is what it is under the totality of the circumstances. It's weighed to the extent that it has any value in the context of the entire situation that's being viewed. I'm assuming if we're talking about a commitment of some sort, a civil commitment of some sort, so there's some event that has occurred or is occurring in which some medical professional, law enforcement, or somebody is making, whoever has this authority, a decision to hold this person.
Right. Senator Menace, what I heard from Dale was sort of testimony about use of the arrest records and the other information during the seven-day period where that information will be fully investigated, examined. There's an attorney who represents the individual. The judge will be able to assess and value whether the arrest, understand the whole picture. That will not happen. That will not happen in the 24-hour turnaround. There will be no evaluation, no assessment, no analysis of the data that's given in the middle of the night potentially to the mental health.
How's that different than and I'm recollecting back to when I was responsible for civilly committing people, my access to those same records in making a decision to fill out a statement that indicated, you know, what the reasons were that I was seeking a hold. I mean, I had access to it, and I looked at it, and it seemed to be relevant to me, at least in the totality of the circumstance. Why is that different in a law enforcement context than it would be for someone who's a mental health professional?
Well, Senator Minnis, again, unfortunately, I wish there were others here this morning who could testify who are far more knowledgeable about this process, so I apologize if I can't fully answer your question. But I think when, you know, police officers look at the LEADS, you've had training, you're certified, you're able to analyze and look at the material and the issue. In this case, and you're not making the decision to hold, I assume you're giving some information to someone. In this case, this is going to the person who's not been certified or trained to understand all this information. It could be inaccurate. And the determination whether to actually restrain someone's very freedoms because they presented danger at that moment, just don't think the safeguards are there. And my understanding was that mental health division, everyone who testified was opposed to that portion of the bill, that the original one that allowed access during the 7-day period, folks were either neutral or in support of that.
All right. I mean, I'm having a hard time grasping the harm that is presented if these people have access to information. I can't quite understand.
Senator Minnis, the harm is that you have held someone, taken away their freedom, based on what they did 6 months ago, not what they are currently presenting, that they are actually a danger to themselves or others. And I think that is the harm.
But see, I guess, again, I've got to add some context to this, too. In the experiences that I've had in terms of deciding to civilly hold someone, there's usually a fairly significant event ongoing. Some kind of psychotic episode, somebody's walking naked down the middle of I-5, and they're confused, they're disoriented, and they're literally babbling, or they're talking about the tinfoil and the reflective rays of the universe and blah, 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 and they've got problems. So to me, you know, as a police officer, in my simple, keen sense for the obvious, there's a problem.
Right.
And I articulate those things, and having access then to you know, the prior, you know, times this person may or may not have been picked up by police for other mental holds as they're flagged in our system, that's relevant to me in terms of, okay, do I call a relative and say, hey, you know, your aunt's walking naked again down the middle of I-5, or do I put this person into some kind of facility where my assumption is they're going to get treatment?
Senator Minnis, if they present a clear danger to themselves or others at that moment, and in the evaluation of the medical personnel, then there's sufficient evidence, it would seem to me, to hold them.
Right.
But when you're taking away someone's freedoms to go back and look at evidence or information of arrests that may never have led to a conviction, of a good deal of information that can't be thoroughly understood or analyzed, because it could be in the middle of the night where there isn't the time for law enforcement provide context, and it's given to a non-law enforcement personnel to decide the very ultimate of holding someone from this.
I guess, kind of arguing back and forth with.
Right. I mean,
to me, this isn't the information that makes the decision. That is the thing that you're really relying on. It's basically supporting information that gives, I guess, some additional detail to what's going on in this person's life
right.
at the time. So.
And Chairman, I think we may just simply disagree in the fact that if it is not the information that is determinative of whether the person will be held and it shouldn't be released at that point out of context, if it is relevant for the court to analyze during the seven, I mean, we've already stepped forward in this bill to expand it to the 7 days of investigation. And this is going even one step further, and I guess I would say with caution, let's proceed and try the 7-day period, which is new. Let's make sure that that works with the safeguards of having the investigation occur for 7 days, the judicial oversight, the representation of counsel. Let's see if that works, and all the safeguards that we think are there, before we expand it this one step further.
Okay, thank you. Let me bring Bill Hauser and Bob Nickel up just quickly.
Is ACLU neutral in the original bill?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we are also opposed to the bill as it sits before the committee. One of the things that we wanted to let the committee know is that when we get into talking about arrests and using the issue of arrests in types of decision makings,
It means that people like me who are going to be representing those individuals that are held are going to be doing a lot more investigations and trying to determine what was the basis for arrests, whether the arrest was, if it's an old arrest, for example, was it one that was a part of a mental illness issue, or whether it was something that had to actually to do with more just a willful violation of the law, whether it was an arrest that a police officer had a mentally ill person who was in the rain without any shelter and calling up the mental health people, and there might be a trespass or something like that, that there is a violation of the law, but the person was actually taken into custody.
I've done this a lot.
Okay.
And the experiences that I've had, these are not situations where someone's homeless. I mean, in my experience, you've got somebody who has a very serious something going on, like somebody trying to saw their fingers off with a serrated, you know, knife while they're intoxicated for whatever reason, and they're drunk, and you know, anybody with a keen sense for the obvious would see that there's a problem, and someone who has better, more professional skills than me needs to make the determination about treatment. I mean, that's the kind of the framework of law enforcement.
Okay.
Law enforcement, and in the context of this, there are very few beds available for these kind of civil holds, particularly in Multnomah County. So you don't, as police officers, you don't go out willy-nilly trying to find a reason to civilly commit someone, because it is a major pain in the neck, from my experience. It is not something that you want to do just because it just might thinly fit into the framework of that.
I guess, and I appreciate that. When those, you get those situations where someone is clearly mentally ill and clearly a danger to themselves or others, can't take care of themselves, meets that kind of standard, there's no need for the prior arrest to come into any kind of investigative frame, because they are clearly in that area of being committable.
So your argument would be that it's not necessary because mm-hmm. you already have some basis of a person being dangerous to themselves or others.
In the smaller counties, particularly in my county, Yamhill County, we have a jail that has some room in it. Unfortunately, we get those situations where we have the borderline cases where people do get placed in the jail because of more minor types of offenses and minor types of mental illness that might be showing up.
Now, is that, in your opinion, because there are no mental health facilities available?
Yes.
Sir?
For the record, my name is Bob Nickel. I'm Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division in the Office of Mental Health Services. I don't have a lot to add. I think a lot of the arguments have come out. I think the thing that I would point out is that the division has to be concerned about the rights of persons with mental illnesses. And the way this particular amendment is perceived is these people are not accused of a criminal activity. That's not why there's a court hearing. It's a civil proceeding. And so arrests, particularly past arrests, even if considered with 7 days' notice, still seems like that's something that most citizens don't have to worry about in a proceeding that's not a criminal proceeding. And so this feels to consumers of mental health services as if it's a form of stigma. And whether that's right or wrong, I'm just trying to report to you what the perception is.
All right, so, Senator Gordon?
I'm curious. Ms. Taylor was here last week, but I thought, a few days ago, I thought there was a coalition that supported the original bill. Who was all that coalition? Remember that, Mr. Chair?
There was apparently a work group of some.
Work group, sorry. Mental health was part of it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, yes, the Mental Health Division has supported the original version of the bill, which was 2394. Before the modifications were proposed.
The modification came from where?
Excuse me, in that original work group over the summer, there was a majority position and a minority position. And this position was in the minority position. And there was a bill drafted exactly as that A and Gross version as presented.
The work group, please, just for my benefit. I'm sorry, I'd like to know Mr. Nelson still.
If you'd like me to respond to that question, I probably can. This was a work group. The overall work group was comprised of probably 35 individuals. This was a particular subcommittee. It was an interim judiciary committee work group on civil commitment. This subcommittee was comprised of probably 10 or 12 individuals. This particular issue was negotiated over a space of
is my recollection, it would serve three individual meetings to fine-tune it. We had participation from Mary Claire Buckley, who's the administrator for the PSRB, Margaret Taylor, Ingrid Swenson, Phil Chadsey, who's involved, was head of Portland NAMI. Guys, help me out here. Who?
Bob Junedef.
Bob Junedef.
Phil Oaks. What's his name?
Okay, I've heard of it.
There was quite a cross-section from consumers to mental health professionals. Greg Sulliger from Lane County Mental Health was quite involved in this. It's a issue that they've tried to bring forward for, I think this is a third session.
Okay, but and again, the issue is whether or not you provide arrest record to the extent that it's worth anything in the minds of the persons who are making the decision at the time.
Senator Minnis.
ACLU, OCDL would argue that there's some inherent problem or evil that might present itself here, which would be the inappropriate application of this material for the purpose of civilly committing someone. Ms. Taylor, you've got a...
Senator Minnis, the other issue is the timing of the information. And this is crucial because in the A. Engrossed version, the information comes in when the person is in the emergency room and you're trying to make the decision of whether that person should be held right now. In fact, the civil commitment statutes acknowledge that when the person's coming in, there's all kinds of information coming in at that time. You're trying to make the best decision possible of whether that person's going to walk out the door.
Help me in my example that I kind of grilled ACLU and OCDLA on. I mean, again, in my experience, most of these people are manifesting some very, very significant psychological or emotional problems.
Right.
And it's very clear in most cases, at least in my simple-minded, that there is a danger either to themselves or others. So that is the basis upon which you can civilly commit someone. So then argue, why is this other information
necessary? Crucial because in the cases you've described, it's a clear danger to self or to others. They've attempted to cut off their hand with a serrated
knife. But isn't that the legal basis for civil commitment in the first place?
But there also is a group where they're coming in, they're agitated, their family members are describing being threatened, and it's primarily family members and caregivers that are being injured by people out in the community. They're agitated, they're describing that they're going to do future attacks. They're not making sense. They're describing wires. They're describing that they're being hit with electrical shots. They're trying to intimidate you as they're in the room. They're not giving you information. And it's in those kinds of cases where you obviously have a mental disorder that you don't know where this person is coming from. They travel up and down I-5 corridor. They travel from the beach over to the mountains. They end up in our emergency room. And that these are the kinds of cases that are on the edge, that if you knew that this person maybe had committed 5 prior assault ones in the past, this is an agitated, mentally ill individual.
Okay, again, now, if you've got an agitated, mentally ill individual, again, I have to rely on my experience because that's the only thing. More often than not, they're making some form of verbal threats, either to themselves to commit suicide or to harm someone else, or they're doing other things like rambling and making incoherent, disconnected sentences, or other kinds of manifestations, making catatonic schizophrenia or something, or somebody's just simply not talking at all and doesn't reason responsive. I mean, that
but
seems to be a good basis I could articulate, at least for the purpose of the civil whole.
But those people get released because they aren't showing an imminent danger to themselves or to others. You can be very mentally ill and be let out the door because there's no showing of danger to self or to others. The doctor makes the decision about the mental illness, and what this bill does is provide additional information to the doctor about what that person's past has been so the doctor can make a better informed decision. There's 5 days after this whole decision to sort it out before you get to the civil commitment hearing. And in fact, that's where a lot of the cases get
sorted
out.
So you're saying in these cases where it isn't so clear in terms of that imminent danger to yourself or someone else, that this record is important. Okay, Dale, you, I'm kind of switching back and forth here on purpose because I want to make sure I understand where I'm going.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dale Penn again. The reason we believe it is important is this is an important decision, both by the pre-commitment investigator at the initial time and then later on at the hearing where there's legal counsel and where a judge is going to make a decision. And to me, the reason the work group never got any place, and I ended up with a majority-minority report, some people are saying we want to restrict what the investigator has, what the doctor has, and what the judge knows. We don't want anything except convictions to be available. And that is not a wise policy choice. That's all this is about, is let's get a better view of what's happened in this person's life. That's all it does.
All right. Senator Courtney.
So the District Attorney Association was in the minority.
They weren't involved.
Excuse me.
I was not a part of the work group. I've been involved in this issue in past years. We saw the bill, and we support the bill as amended by House Judiciary Committee. But I was not a part, and there was no one from the DA Association part of the work group. If we would have been, we would have been supporting the, quote, minority report, which the House Judiciary developed as the bill.
All right, I want to find out where my committee is. I tend to support the Ambrose version myself. Senator Harper, where are you? Should I have here? Yes. Duncan?
I'm still trying to figure it out.
Okay, still trying to figure it out. Fire. Mr. Metzger?
Not real excited about it.
I'm sorry?
Not real excited.
Not excited about it? Doesn't look like we have a majority unless Senator Duncan.
The chair, like.
You've worked with us longer than I have.
Okay.
I move House Bill 2394, A engrossed with floor, that do pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves House Bill 2394, A engrossed with floor, that Senate do pass recommendation. Discussion. We have objections. Senator Metzger, Senator Courtney objects.
Let me just point out, I don't know where I'm going to be on the floor. I just need more time, and I don't blame the chair, because I think this committee has really been caught on this issue. I have a feeling this thing has been. That's all I'm saying, Mr. Chairman. I simply can't get a picture of what is going on right now and what is in the best interest of whatever. Maybe some of the members can, but I just don't feel certified smart, so we'll see what happens when I get the floor.
Right.
I reserve the right to change my vote on the floor.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I appreciate the courtesy.
Chair, and I did the same thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're fine. Okay. What other issues do we have for left here? I'll carry them.
Do they have the 2092 amendment?
There's 8.
Didn't get out of the house.
8 to 9?
Yeah.
An 8 to 9? Yeah. All righty. Counsel, speak to me on the A9 amendment. Yes, you can't find yours. Okay.
Are they going away, Craig?
They're before the committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 2092 has two amendments before the committee, the dash A8s and dash A9s. Let me explain the dash A8s first. This is a bill that would amend the statutory definition of probable cause so that when you see in lines 18 through 22 of the bill that says the activation of electronic article surveillance system, that's the little thing that's on the clothes when you buy them and the shopkeeper takes them off. When that is activated, that constitutes probable cause for purposes of this section. I will say in regards to this amendment, that would not constitute probable cause as far as the Constitution, in my understanding. This is a statute, just to make that clear.
I don't understand what you just said, counsel. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I don't know what you just said.
Mr.
The lawyer, you just went right by
Mr. Chairman, Center Court, meaning the court gets to decide what probable cause means for purposes of arrest under the Fifth Amendment, for Miranda or for a seizure of a person. Under the Fourth Amendment, that's a U.S. constitutional issue. And under the Oregon Constitution, probable cause means you can arrest. So this is a statute that the legislature has set.
We've got a discussion that's going to go around and around.
No, I'll make it simpler, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cordy. You can't change what probable cause means for purposes of the Constitution by amending the statute.
You're just saying the court ultimately gets to say
right.
What it really means.
Exactly. Correct. And
so, you know, we put probable cause in here. That doesn't mean it's probable cause.
Anyone else want to take a crack at
it? Well, I'm not doing that.
Yeah,
that's
kind of
why what you're saying. Yeah.
The constitutionally, probable cause is a very important issue. And this is a statute.
Constitutional amendment.
So that, right. The A9s, are the what was Senate Bill 95, which amends the definition of for a probationer, what is a home visit?
This is it's a bill that we sent out that's run into a bit of an issue or problem or roadblock over in the House.
Correct.
And this is to deal with the which case again was it Gomez?
Guzman.
There we go. Guzman case. Everybody remember this?
2092.
Plenty of time.
I don't have any amendments.
A9. Do you look at them? They were in your packet, so.
You have the A9s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, the A9s. The A9s, okay, I'm sorry,
So this is the Guzman case that we passed out in the Senate bill that's now hung up over in the House for one reason or another. And the A8s are.
Okay. Let me ask this. I want to make sure in terms of reading these things, the existing language in 29.2, it's coming out?
It goes away.
Coming out.
All that's coming out.
All right.
Yeah, I just want to know. I mean, it's somewhat significant.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to move the dash. Let me just start. Can I start with the dash 9 amendments?
Yes, sure.
Excuse me, I move the dash 9 amendments to House Bill 2092.
Senator Cordy moves the adoption of the A9 amendments to House Bill 2092. Discussion? Any objections?
Going to take discussion or anything on the other
one? Now on the A8s, let's bring up where is he?
Gary.
Fred Meyer, Gary Oxley. Come on up. Tell us why we're doing this. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley appearing before you this morning representing Fred Meyer, Safeway, and Rite Aid. The amendment before you, the dash A8, was originally prepared at the request of the Northwest Retail Loss Prevention Association, of which my clients are members. The amendment provides clarity in the existing probable cause statute. Specifically, what the amendment does is it provides that the activation of an electronic surveillance system as a result of a person leaving a store or a protected area within a retail establishment would constitute probable cause and provide the retailer with reasonable suspicion for stopping someone and making an inquiry. These machines you've seen in all retail facilities such as Meyer & Frank's, G.I. Joe's, Fred Meyer, and when someone walks through with a product that has not been scanned properly, the activation of the machine goes off, and this statute or this amendment would clearly provide us an opportunity to stop an individual and make a reasonable inquiry as to whether or not the product had been properly scanned, whether it's our error or whether some other incident has possibly taken place. AOI, Julie Brandis, also supports this amendment on behalf of their members such as Fred Meyer, G.I. Joe's, Bi-Mart, et cetera, and we would appreciate your consideration and adoption of the amendment.
Reporting.
Now, Gary, you were good enough to come see me early this morning.
Correct.
You can stop them now, right? Obviously, when that thing goes off, because I'm around, you can stop the person now.
As provided in Section 1 of ORS 131655, that is correct, Mr.
And you can,
Senator Courtney.
If you can stop them, you can talk to them, right?
Correct.
You can't do a body search, but you can talk to them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cornyn, correct.
So by putting probable cause in there, that helped me. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out what more that does.
Let me try to explain it. The issue is not necessarily the extension of this probable cause language. What it does is it prevents some of these companies from being sued, which is in a civil environment, because this is happening on a frequent basis for false arrest or some kind of a custody issue that isn't clear in the statutes. In other words, they're making stops based on these particular
right.
devices going off.
Right.
They're being civilly sued by a number of individuals.
Because the person has nothing on them, you mean?
Well, Gary,
there's a mistake machine or something?
In some instances, that could be the case, where the product is improperly scanned or something to that effect. But clearly, these machines provide a great service to retailers. They deter crime. They deter theft. And we're trying to clarify in statute that though the activation of those machines does provide probable cause.
All right.
Thank you.
Dale, do you, you have an opinion on this? I'm dragging you.
I don't understand. Just say no.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dale Penn, state police were wanting an amendment on this also, but no, I understand the concern is it is a civil liability issue. It's not going to have any impact whatsoever in the criminal justice system. But I assume the stores are concerned that we put in this equipment to help us monitor this. And yet what is happening is if we react to our equipment, our alarms, we are sued. And so this equipment is useless, and we have a terrible shoplifting problem. We're trying to stop that. This is an assistance in that. So I know that's where they're coming from, but it really doesn't have criminal law impact.
Gary, you represent Fred Meyers, correct?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Tell me what you do when you have a loss security prevention person who... How do you regulate their behavior, their conduct, their, I guess, their work in general? If you have someone who makes a bad arrest or a bad stop or, you know, they're doing something where they're being too aggressive, how does Fred Meyers deal with that?
Mr. Chair, in response to your question, it's my understanding that the security people go through extensive training programs. They have procedures that they're to follow in terms of making a stop and an inquiry. The retail business is very, very competitive, as you understand, and it is not to the advantage of any company to stop and harass people for no reason at all or in an improper situation. The competition is very right. severe out there, and it's not a good idea to chase consumers away.
All right. Senator Cornyn.
I'm reading House Bill 3535, which was introduced with this in it in the House and did not get out of the House. But here's the thing. I'm reading the existing statute, Gary, and I cannot see right now, or maybe you can convince me otherwise, where this is going to keep you from getting sued either. I don't see where that's going to keep you from getting sued. In view of the existing language, it already says in there that, you know, the peace officer or thereafter the person brings against a peace officer, merchant, or merchant employer any civil or criminal acts based upon detention and interrogation, such probable cause shall be a defense to the action if the detention interrogation was done in a reasonable manner and for a reasonable period of time.
Well,
I don't know.
Mr.
You just
Chair,
say the statutory definition of probable cause, please. I think the issue here, if I can try to frame this, is that generally probable cause is based on a set of facts that are articulated that says, in essence, that a particular crime has occurred and that more likely than not a particular person has committed a crime based on the articulation of those facts. What this does is says that in and of itself, the activation of one of these devices is the basis of probable cause, notwithstanding the definition of probable cause that exists in statute. So basically, that's what it does, in essence, is it raises that up to a level where they don't have to or would not have to articulate all of these other facts in order to get to the probable cause level, because the other section of the statute existing now requires probable cause in order to justify their action.
Okay. Well, Gary, you did tell me that the suits you're winning the suits.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Cornyn, could you repeat, please?
Are you prevailing in the lawsuits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cornyn, we are.
Right. So it isn't though the courts are jacking you around here in terms of you're telling them obviously the evidence
you obviously bring up the activation of this device. That obviously is brought into court on you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I could, I think the distinction here is that on the reasonable person test, what's going to happen there is going to go to trial, and so a jury will make that decision. If this statute were in law, then if there was a lawsuit, the store would be able to ask for a directed verdict and moot this out at a pretrial motion stage. Because the alarm did go off, that's why we detained this person just to inquire. I think that's really what this statute is all about.
Okay. Are we going to hear from the state police, too?
Now, I'm assuming ACLU, OCDLA, you guys probably have a real problem with this, but I could tell by that.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Bill Hauser with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. In response to Senator Courtney's question, what we're doing here with this is we're creating a legal fiction that we learned in law school about. We're creating legal fiction that something that probably is reasonable suspicion is being reached up to probable cause. Because when the thing goes off, that little doohickey that goes off when you walk through the doors, what that does is it causes a reason to stop and detain and ask questions, which is a reasonable suspicion standard for a police officer. What this is establishing is that for the purpose of that thing going off, we are going to create that to be probable cause, which will allow for the civil liability to go away for the store owner when they make mistakes and they don't clear the little thingy that goes off. We do have a problem with that. We think that we should not mess around with those legal standards, that is a reasonable suspicion, not a probable cause standard. And particularly in light of if you look up, and I've got the amendment in front of me that's proposed on line 5, peace officers are included in the statute, so peace officers would also be covered.
Let me ask you a quick question. Do you have a different fix to this problem?
Well, I think that if probable cause, if you just wanted to say it was reasonable suspicion, yes. If we're going to take away liability.
I think the issue is that these persons who are responding as security or whatever they're called, loss prevention persons, when these things go off, are making a stop.
Mm-hmm.
Probable cause generally relates to an arrest, the basis for an arrest. And I think what they really need to get to is the basis, a legal, defensible position to say, we're stopping you and we have a legal foundation for doing that, i.e., this machine just went off and I can stop you and ask you reasonable questions about your activities and what you're doing. Now, that's a little bit different. That gets to the reasonable suspicion thing. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying in your legal mind, is there another fix that you can find that doesn't get us to the level that you're... I want to drag you into this discussion so that Jason could call up you.
Are you saying that
they're recording?
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
So when you're going to go into an airport, people would allow themselves to be body searched on a second. Mm-hmm. Nobody asking questions, and that thing goes off. What kind of standard applies there?
Reasonable suspicion. Actually, I don't know what the legal standard is, but when you get onto an airplane, because of the nature of the thing, that you're consenting to certain types of...
You better believe it, buddy. 32,000 feet, 400 miles an hour. Search me all you want, and everybody else.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, if you're going to the airport and the either there's something when you put your carry-on luggage through the X-ray machine or when you go through the metal detector, if that goes off, all those people have right then is a reasonable suspicion to stop and ask reasonable questions. They do not have probable cause to arrest you at that period of time. And it's that jump from stopping and asking reasonable questions to arrest. Now, obviously, if they keep having you go through the metal detector and it keeps going off, they run the wand over you and it keeps going off, that is giving them, you're emptying your pockets, there's nothing else that you have on you visibly that's creating this, you have no medical condition that would require it, that you can tell them about, that the wand would go off. That's now raising it from reasonable suspicion, perhaps, to probable cause, where they can then detain you more and search you beyond your consent.
I don't think, you just went off on me. Everybody keeps causing reasonable suspicion. I think Gary told me this morning they tried another standard letter. Lane Shetterly wanted to try another standard. Legislative counsel said that didn't help. Reasonable suspicion? You're saying you could live with reasonable suspicion as opposed to probable cause. Our legislative counsel is saying that didn't help.
it probably wouldn't solve their problem of civil liability.
Right.
I think that that's a training issue. Police officers are trained how to respond in reasonable suspicion situations and probable cause situations.
Well, except that more likely than not, you're going to have some other thing that's happened. Police officers don't respond just to the mere alarm and, mm-hmm. and you know, that does, I guess, in terms of if you're always responding to an alarm and a right. burglary, and I see someone running away from the residence where the burglary is at, and those under the totality of the circumstances gives me a broader basis. Here we're just talking about the mere fact the person walks through one of these electronic devices and it goes off.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, I think we're trying to resolve that problem. It's to say that someone who works for this firm has at least a basis to stop the person and say,
Mr. Chair, I think the difference is it's not the stopping that's causing the question about civil liability. It's the use of physical force after the stop. When there's reasonable suspicion, you do not have the ability to use physical force. If there's probable cause, the security guards can make a citizen's arrest, and the statute gives them the ability to use physical force to go to that citizen's arrest. It's the use of physical force which is causing the problem for civil liability and the concern for civil liability. It's not the stopping. It's the arresting and use of physical force. And you have to have probable cause to rise up to the use of physical force. Reasonable suspicion won't give that to you.
You know that because you've seen some of these cases? Or?
Yeah, I have seen some of these cases.
Senator Harper, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem, as it was explained to me, was the bill goes off in the stores because they have deep pockets are getting sued. How do we fix that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, it seems to me that there's one way to certainly reduce the amount of times that the bell goes off, and that would be proper training and proper deactivation by the clerks, so that when the bell goes off, it's not a employee fault, or if it goes off, the employees that come and deal with that situation are properly trained to how to deal with that situation. Police departments are trained to, and police officers are trained to not use physical force when they have only reasonable suspicion, but be able to articulate probable cause before they use physical force.
Can I ask, I want to clarify something too. When you're talking about physical force, are you talking about actually taking someone into custody, i.e. putting handcuffs on them? Or are you talking about actually having to overcome some resistance on the part of the person who's stopped physically? Because there is a difference.
Right. I think, Mr. Chair, that, you know, if you have somebody, a security guard that comes up and says, look, this activation thing came off and the person takes off running,
right.
and the person's yelling, security, security, stop, and they keep running, I think you've now elevated from reasonable suspicion to probable cause. That security officer, just by the fact that the person running away, when the person identifies themselves as security, requests that person to stop, the bell's going off, that's now raised it up to probable cause that they have the ability to use physical force. However, if the bell goes off, the person stops, and they want to take them and handcuff them, that's where there's a problem.
The problem you're articulating, the way you're articulating, is the same problem we have when somebody bails out of a car that we're chasing. They're running, you know, our response is, let's go get them. In this case, you've got an alarm goes off, you say, hi, I'm security, the guy bolts.
And
don't have a basis.
I think that's probable cause. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that running
that's
from a police officer is probable cause.
Wait a minute. No. You've got, again, you go back to the statutory definition of probable cause and read it. Is someone merely not stopping and running away from a police officer or anybody else who says, hi, I'm a police officer, all I can articulate is an alarm went off, the guy ran. That's not probable cause.
If the security guard says the alarm went off, I identified myself as security, the person takes off, I think that is raised to the level of probable cause at that period of time.
I would disagree with you 100%. I don't think any judge I know is going to say that's probable cause. I would have to articulate that I saw something more, i.e. perhaps one of the pieces of merchandise fell out of his pants, that I, you know, and it was our merchandise,
right.
something in addition to just the alarm went off, the guy ran after I said hi. You understand what I'm saying?
Senator, Chairman Ennis, I do understand what you're saying. I also know that I have represented a large number of youth who have received robbery charges after running from a security guard. They get tackled, they struggle, the security guard gets hit in some way, and that then turns into a robbery charge for those individuals.
Now escalated to the point that there's some physical resistance and the person's now fighting or striking at the security person. That's different. I'm talking about the mere basis that all this security guard knows is the alarm went off, this person just went through the thing, I'm now confronting them, and they bolt and run.
Yes.
You're telling me that's probable cause. I'm saying to you, in my infantile mind, that is not probable cause. I don't know any judge is going to support that.
And in terms of the criminal liability, Your Honor, Mr. Chair, the fact of the matter is that the when that happens, and as counsel said, this statute will not affect the criminal area whatsoever, because the person is, if there's a citizen's arrest, there's a citizen's arrest, and if the citizen did not have the statutory ability to arrest that person, that's not a bar for criminal prosecution. It comes in on the civil liability, and it's the difference between being able to use the physical force or not having the physical force.
Help me with this, because likewise, let's say if we adopted this and this is in place and now we're saying that yes, it is probable cause, you can stop them. This doesn't prevent a lawsuit from proceeding where there's unreasonable physical force that might have occurred in taking the person into custody. This doesn't prevent that. This just says literally, to the extent that the alarms went off, this person walked through, now I can stop you, I have probable cause for that purpose. It doesn't seem to me that it's a problem in terms of future lawsuits for unreasonable conduct or behavior on behalf of the person who's making the stop.
Mr. Chair, I would agree to you that the standard then goes up to whether the physical force was unreasonable. But the question then becomes, if you're a citizen that has just purchased something at one of these stores, you have not stolen anything, you then go through the electronic thing, it goes off, you stop, all right, and a security guard comes up to you,
okay.
You let them look through your package, there's nothing in the package, they then say to you,
but
you're
going
to go back to the room with us and slap handcuffs on you, you're going to be a little bit upset about that, all right, and that, I don't think, under the definition of the physical force allowed for a citizen arrest, would be unreasonable under those circumstances.
What you are articulating to me sounds unreasonable. Because if I was the security person and I stopped the person outside and they allow me to look through their packages and they don't have any merchandise, and then I say, you're coming with me.
Because they want to search to see if you have anything in your pockets or that you're wearing anything.
This doesn't give you a basis to search.
They don't need a constitutional basis to search. They can search.
All right. Hang on. This is unraveling right in front of my eyes.
Actually, I think that with the passage of this amendment, when we talk about the establishment of probable cause, it would give them the right to do things other than just stop and detain and ask questions, because that's what probable cause means. It means that you can take that next step of taking them into, come with me, I want to search you personally, I want to search through your bag, that type of thing. So
okay.
I think that it would allow that.
All right.
Okay. I'm just curious in this whole thing. I'm trying to remember, having been in this situation myself one time, it triggered the alarm. I stopped immediately, turned around to look at somebody. There was no security person. I walked back to the clerk. They had not taken, but I had the sales slip. Okay. Wouldn't they immediately ask to see the sales slip? I mean, doesn't the typical person hand you the sales slip to somebody? Isn't that what generally happens?
Senator, yes.
Yes.
I mean, I'm trying to visualize this whole setting. It's an embarrassing, and for a moment, my gosh, the bell's going off. I'm not a crook. I mean, you stand and turn around. I'm not a crook.
Say that again.
Well, I guess.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I think you answered what I was getting at. And my concern, Mr. Chair, too, is the elevation to probable cause elevating the ability to essentially search me, you know, is really a just based on an electronic device, really concerns me, especially when, at least anecdotally, my understanding is most of these are the failure of the store, not of the individual. So I, you know, I don't think why, as an individual, my personal freedom should be compromised on the fact that, you know, electronic device under the control of someone else is not. Well, it may be functioning correctly, but the operation between salespeople, whatever. And I was in the same situation, Mr. Chair, that Senator Duncan was.
Yeah, but I think
it was Meyer and Frank. You know, where you know you're getting things from different departments, and the person with the socks didn't take the thing off. And in that situation, you know, they didn't actually detain me. They asked me, and I, you know, I was happy to do that. But the fact that you know, if 60 or 70 or 80 or 90% of these are an a management problem with the store, I don't think I should give up my personal rights to that. I mean, if I have a roast under my coat, you know, that's probable cause. But I think, you know, if there was a 98% of the 98% of these alarms were legitimate alarms, and then they have a problem, I would feel more sympathetic than the fact that 90% of them is a management problem. Why I should have to give it up.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do, because I have to be in two different meetings right now at the same time.
You can do it. If anybody could, Mr. Chair, you could.
don't we have another radon committee that we have?
That's what you and I are supposed to be in.
Yeah. What I want to do is, I think everybody understands the framework of the situation. I want to recess the committee, and if I could get you and Dale and some legal minds together and say, how can we resolve this issue? But because we may be able to add some language here that says that one of these clerks may not unreasonably, you know, detain someone or whatever that might be, that bring the comfort level up here. Are you willing to do that, Bill?
Well, I'll stick around here and talk to you.
Okay, in good faith, right?
Well, absolutely.
All right.
Just so you know,
we're going to be in recess
until
at the call of the chair, I'll put an announcement out.
For what it's worth, this morning, you know, I get up early to run. I set off a car alarm.